All right, so let's go ahead and get started. So, let's see here. I'm good right now. So my wife told me this morning I was too chipper to be talking about General Assembly. But nothing gets a Presbyterian more excited than talking about General Assembly. So this is going to be a preview of our General Assembly that's coming up. So we'll, a week from tomorrow, I will head out to Birmingham, and Leslie and I will be there for the week. And so that's where this year's General Assembly is, so nice and close by. So very different than St. Louis, where Boaz and I went last year. So it's nice to be, not to have to go so far, even though we do like seeing new places. So let's go ahead and pray, and we'll jump right into this. So, Heavenly Father, we thank you for this time to gather together to consider the work of the church, and so we just pray that you give us wisdom, Father, as we think about the General Assembly and the work of our denomination. We pray this in Jesus' name, Amen. Now, does anybody know what the General Assembly is? No, it's actually just, yes, within our denomination, right? So it is the gathering of our church, essentially. So our denomination is the Presbyterian Church in America, and that is a one singular entity that is expressed in local churches. And so the point is that there is a connectionalism. That's what Presbyterianism is all about. There's a connectionalism. Because, for instance, like the Southern Baptist Convention, there's a reason it's called the convention, because it's essentially participatory. It's voluntary, right? They signed up, they paid the dues, they followed some of the rules or most of the rules, and so they join together to kind of work alongside each other. But the decisions they make there are not binding upon any particular church, because. Baptist churches are independent churches, right? They're congregational governments. So Baptists highly value church autonomy. So they believe that each church is essentially autonomous unto itself and is not to be kind of interfered with by other churches. Whereas Presbyterians, we say, no, we're not a hierarchy like Episcopals or Methodists or Roman Catholics. Well, you have like, priests and bishops, and you have this hierarchy of different people. Rather, there are no teaching elders that can operate without a specific call. There is no teaching elder who's like over the Mississippi Valley Presbytery, like you would find a bishop over a church diocese in the Episcopal Church or perhaps even like the Methodist Church. So we operate. Presbyterian Church operates through a series of courts that have different rules and different members, and different jobs. But the basic idea of Presbyterianism is connectionalism between the churches and rule by elder. We are ruled by teaching elders and ruling elders, who represent the local churches, and so we gather together once a year to deal with business that has to do with how our denomination runs. All right, our General Assembly does not meet to convene, does not convene and discuss what Bailey Presbyterian is doing for BBS this year. Right? Because that's not their job. Right? They don't come together to tell us, the particulars of our ministries, of like when to schedule things, how to operate on a day-to-day basis, because that's not the job, the jurisdiction of the General Assembly. The General Assembly is saying, look, we handle things that have to do with the denomination as a whole. And so, changes to our Book of Church Order, things like review of all the records of Presbytery. So, all the records of our session, all the minutes from our session meetings, they all get reviewed by our Presbytery every year. Every year, they go through them and they let us know: did you screw up or did you pass? Like, did you mess them up? And if you did, fix this. Or if there's a serious error, then you need to respond and let us know what in the world's going on. It's a way to check in and to keep people accountable. And so, but then also, the records of all the presbyteries get checked every year at General Assembly. And so actually, it's going on right now. There's guys already in Birmingham, and they're going over in what's called a review of Presbytery records, which is as exciting as it sounds. All right? Just scintillating stuff there. So, but it is important. This is what's, this is a form of accountability that we call review and control. And that we don't have things that are just kind of slipping by, right? That we actually are reviewing what are the decisions that are being made by all the 88 presbyteries within our denomination. And so this is how we keep accountable to one another. And this is that part of that connectionalism. We are accountable to other churches. We are accountable to other presbyteries. We are accountable to one another because we are one church, the Presbyterian Church in America. Now I am actually one of the additional duties. So I'm going as a representative of our church and our presbytery to the General Assembly, and I'm what's called a commissioner. So I get to vote. We pay for my registration, and the church pays for my travel expenses. And go there, and I vote on things, all right? And so, but an additional duty that I don't perform every year, but this year I get to perform again, is something called the Committee of Commissioners. So, you've heard of Mission to the World Committee, Mission to North America, you know? So, well, those are committees. Well, the question is, who are they accountable to? Who's checking their stuff? Well, that's what the Committee of Commissioners does. So before General Assembly begins, the Committee of Commissioners meets on Monday and Tuesday and reviews all the minutes and decisions of every committee, that the denomination committee, and reviews all those, approves anything, discusses any requests that the committee's making of the General Assembly, and makes their recommendations to the General Assembly itself. And so, this year I'm sitting on the CDM committee, formerly the Christian Education Committee, but now the Committee of Discipleship Ministries. And so I've reviewed all the minutes in my preparation for that, and there's really nothing, major going on. Now we work in tangent with, you know, the Show Me Jesus curriculum that we use for our Sunday school material. So that comes from Great Commission Publications, which is a joint effort between the PCA and the OPC. Now, actually, what's interesting is that the majority of sales of Sunday school curriculum goes to denominations outside of the PCA and the OPC. It is a highly used curriculum, but they took a big hit over the COVID period, where they essentially had to cut their budget in half. So they really took some big hits over the last year. So you can be in prayer for that, because it's a great ministry. They put out a lot of good materials that we make use of. So we're glad that you make use of that and support them. But that's part of our review of the connection with Great Commission Publications as well. So I can tell you, there's basically nothing going on there. I really like serving in committee of commissioners. Other guys don't like to do it. I like to do it because it helps me to get to know our denomination. Like I sit on the Committee of Commissioners for the PCA Foundation 1 year, and it's like, what is the PCA Foundation? Well, basically, it's if you have a fair amount of money and you're trying to figure out the best way to maybe leave a gift to the church when you after you pass away, or even just how to handle, set up maybe an anonymous charitable giving, things like that. The PCA Foundation is there to help, counsel, and guide, and give people advice. And so so they do that, and they do a good job. So which is different from the PCA RBI, which is retirement benefits. it's a great way for me to go nerd out on our Presbyterian denomination. So that's really what it is. So. I like serving on it, and I get to meet other teaching elders that I don't know. In fact, I look at the committee, and I don't know. I don't think I know anybody on that's serving on my committee of commissioners this year. So, but it'll be interesting to get to know them and get to know and work together. So, that's just a little bit about what it is, what we're doing, and how, kind of introduction as we get into it. So, I'm going to give you some brief statistics
Because, again, I mean, nothing more exciting than statistics, but the numbers are what people want to know oftentimes, and they help just give you a snapshot, right? Numbers aren't everything, but they do help give you a snapshot and to understand trends, and especially, you know, how has COVID affected our church as a denomination as a whole. We also have to bear in mind there are a lot of churches that don't report their statistics. We do. But a lot of churches don't. And so the statistics are always skewed a bit because there are a lot of churches that just don't report. And we can't penalize them. We don't have any kind of mechanism for penalizing churches. We're not reporting, and so it's entirely voluntary. So, but we get over half at least that report. And then basically they kind of guess. But based on the information we have, now we do know we do have 88 presbyteries. That is confirmed. So, now we do have also, we have 1,593 churches in our denomination, which is a net increase of 13 over the years. 1,593.
Is that in just in the state of
Mississippi? No, that's in North America. Yeah, that's in the United States. In the United States. So, we have mission churches, our church plants. We have 318 church plants, which is actually down by 30. Now, part of that is because a bunch of those became full churches. So once you do that, you move out, and then several dissolve. Not every church plant works, right? Church planting is risky business. It's you're taking a risk. Even if it's a solid area and it's dark, you know, we're sure it's going to be great. You never know. So it's just, you know, the Lord knows, but you don't know. So, you know, the church plant we're supporting in Monroe, it is going well. You know, Harris Bond, he is meeting for worship, but we don't know whether or not it's going to continue, you know. So, but it's continuing. We're praying. It seems to be going well, but we just say, hey, you know, so these guys, they go to plant these churches. They do it, you know, knowing that, hey, this could not work. It's possible. It happened many, many times. And so, but it is the Lord that gives the growth when it happens. So, let's see here. And it's the Lord who shuts them down. So he's in control. So we trust that. So we're doing a GA preview. So there was some preview. So we're going running through some statistics right now. So, we have, teaching elders as pastors. We have 5,159, pastors. Now note that's 5,159 teaching elders in our denomination. We have 1,593 churches. So now that also includes teaching elder missionaries, teaching elders who are serving, and we've got several. Number of teaching elders that serve as professors in seminaries. So it's not all. All of these are not directly serving in the local church ministry, but most of them are. And so, we have, let's see here, we have 704 candidates for the ministry that are in process right now. That's anywhere from, on average, from a 3 to 4 year process, you know. And so, let's see here. We have, professions of faith by children. So this would be children who came to faith either by coming into the church or as covenant children coming up and professing their faith. We had 4,479 professions of faith by children last year, and that is up by 456 from the previous year. And we also have professions of faith by adults of 4,674 adults professed faith last year. And so that is people professing faith, you know, for the first time as they come into the church. So, and that is an increase from the previous year of 383. So, let's see here. It's interesting though. Even though we have those wonderful numbers, our total membership is 378,389. So we've close to, you know, just over 375,000 members. But that is down almost 5,000 from the previous year. So even though we have gained, essentially, it looks like almost 10,000 members. We lost more. So now Sunday school declined during COVID and has not recovered. So we in 2019 we had approximately 65,000 members attending Sunday school, and 95,000. And since COVID hit, it has been 65,000, and stayed there the last 2 years. So Sunday school has taken a hit by about a third. So it's pretty heavy. Total contributions are very strong for the church in terms of giving. So our total contributions were basically just shy of $1 billion for the denomination as a whole. That includes missions, church planting, tithes and offerings, everything.
Billion.
Just shy of $1 billion. So, yeah. So it was actually just over $1 billion previous year, 2021, and then it went 2020, and then it went down just slightly, dipped just below that. But still very strong. So, we do have a concern. The average age of PCA members is 55. So, now you compare that to the average age of Muslims in the United States, which is 32. So 55, it's not that, you know, that's for an average age. It just means that you have an older congregation as a church. We are the fourth oldest among the major denominations. We're younger than the Methodists and the Episcopalians, but we are the oldest among evangelical denominations, but we're roughly the same as the Southern Baptists and slightly older than the Assemblies of God. So from their statistics comparing them, this has come from the Stated Clerks Report. And so there is clearly a need for outreach and evangelism denomination-wide, reaching out to those around us, not just to, you know, liven up, but it just, what, like I said, these numbers, these statistics, these things, they just present us with a snapshot, right? They just give us a picture of what the trend is, and it highlights, hey, what the needs are. And then, and no surprise, I mean, we would say that the need every year is outreach and evangelism, but it is truly, it is important to consider that as far as the makeup of the church as well. Now, so those are some concerns that we need to think about. Some strengths, we have a very strong ministry core. We have a lot of well-trained ministers. We have a lot of candidates in the pipeline. I mean, there are literally denominations, they cannot get ministers. They get people that will just get in there, but they can't get qualified ministers. And part of that is because they're a liberal denomination, there's not a lot of people who want to be ministers in that denomination. And so they're begging for ministers. And so, we are not. We have a very strong ministry core. Our church planting efforts are very strong and continue to strong. We are planting churches. And planting churches is one of the best means of evangelism. Particularly if you're talking about it, long-term, strong, continuous evangelism, planting churches is number one. It is the best way to reach people for Christ. Now, it doesn't mean that it's talking about our own personal efforts in our own area, but in terms of the denomination, church planting remains the best way to reach out into long term, and to not only bring people into the faith, but to keep them in. And so, and then also we continue to be well resourced as a denomination, financially, and also in terms of our resources, are be able to in terms of documentation, theology, all those things. We are very well resourced in those areas. So those are some strengths. The committee reports, basically looking over all the denominational committee reports from the MNA and the MCW and the administration committee and the Committee of Constitutional Business. That's a fun one. There's not really any major like concerns or big issues. These are good reports. Things they're reporting, good things happening, without getting a lot of details. But I really want to spend the most of our time, or the rest of our time, talking about overtures. Because overtures are the meat and potatoes of General Assembly. That's where the debates happen. That's where the action is in General Assembly. And overtures are weird. It's taken me years to figure out how General Assembly works. Because we have 42 overtures that have been submitted by various presbyteries. Plus, we have 7 overtures that were held over from the previous year. So that means we have 49 overtures, which last year we had like 60-something overtures because we didn't have General Assembly during COVID. So this is actually down a little bit than what we had to deal with last year. But there is no shortage of controversy still that we're dealing with here. So the seven overtures, so an overture is basically a presbytery, or even a church in certain instances, is asking the General Assembly to do something, to take an action, to alter the Book of Church Order, to make a statement publicly. That's what an overture is. It's requesting something. It's like if you're in a meeting and someone makes a motion. It's to take an action of some sort. And so these are different actions. And so those holdover overtures from the previous year, basically, they all have to deal, they're basically all about clarifying procedures when handling discipline cases. And so there's not really a lot to say about those. Most of them are pretty good, kind of giving some better clarity about certain things. There's one that is not good, and I don't think it's going to pass, and I will vote against it. There's one that was asking for the expansion of. So basically, what happens is if there's two types of discipline cases, generally speaking. If let's say a minister comes under discipline, okay. He's committed some kind of grievous sin. He's stolen money from the church. We'll just say that. Okay, and he got busted, and so he's been brought up on charges. And so, but he says he's innocent. Okay. Well, guess what happens? He has to have a trial. Okay. Now, one can confess and simply say confess. Or, for instance, if you have a church member who is accused of a grievous sin. And they refuse to repent of it. They refuse to. Well, church discipline requires that, essentially, that they be brought to a trial. And you actually have to appoint a prosecutor, and you have to go through the whole thing. And it is a mess, and it's really, really difficult. But it is necessary. And so, what they're saying is
talking about a legal trial or inside the church?
Talking about a church trial. Yeah, just a church. Yeah, inside the church. Yeah, and so. But it says at the church, we have rules about what witnesses you can call, and you are not allowed to call witnesses that don't believe in God. Because you cannot, we do not honor the testimony of atheists within the church as part of a church trial. And so we believe that it is morally necessary to have someone who believes in eternal judgment, to make oaths and swear to tell the truth and to, you know, so basically, there's a motion to expand witness eligibility to include those who do not, basically all the way up to atheists, to be able to bring more witnesses in. And you can understand the argument there, but as a church, we just don't believe it's going to be wise to open that door to allow atheists or others who do not believe, do not hold to the faith, to testify within a church court. So be voting against that. I don't think it's going to go anywhere. It's funny. One that's gotten a lot of excitement from teaching elders and ruling elders who go to General Assembly is overture number one, which is the overtures committee report. So basically, what happens is there's all these overtures. Okay, most of these overtures are going to get sent over to the overtures committee, which meets prior to the General Assembly. The overtures committee will take all these overtures. And then they will basically take them, and then there's one of these that, like, basically they'll take something that's dealing, sometimes there's like six overtures that deal with the same thing. Okay? And so what they'll do is they'll pick one, the best one, and then it'll just attach all the others to it. And then they'll just say, we're presenting this one as the representative of all those, and we recommend you vote for it or against it. That's what they do. They'll say, we recommend you vote for this or against this, vote this against it. And so when it comes to actually vote on the assembly floor, what's weird is you're not voting for the overture itself. You're voting about the overture's committee's recommendation of the overture, which can get really confusing because they'll say, I'm going to vote yes to affirm the overture's committee saying I should vote no on this thing. You know, so you're just kind of like, and sometimes people will stop. They'll stop and they will ask. So like, Mr. Moderator, please explain what we're voting here. let's simplify the language here. But it is an important process to help simplify these things and and so I'm going to go through some of these. But the problem is that we don't have like a The stated time for the overtures committee report is like 3 o'clock on like Thursday afternoon, which means that if you're doing the most important debates and the most important business and starts at 3 p.m. on Thursday, and we're supposed to leave Friday, well, guess what that means? It means that there's been multiple years where we didn't get done until 1 in the morning. And so, and it's just kind of like, it's okay, well, and so they're saying, look, no one's fresh and making good decisions after 11, right? Like, it's just not good, you know? And not all the guys going there are spring chickens, right? So it's like this, people are tired, they are emotional, sometimes we just blow through things and don't give them enough time to take up consideration. And so it's just like, so they said, look, we need to set it to just move it to Thursday morning at 9 a.m. Like, just, you know, just kind of, let's just stop this and start doing the most important business that's going. So I think it's going to pass. There is some strong pushback from the administrative committee on this. They don't like it for some reason. But most of the guys I'm hearing from are, like myself, going, yes, please, we need to stop having these midnight 1 a.m. sessions where we're handling the most important business of the General Assembly. It just doesn't make sense. So, all right. Well, so that's number one. Let's see here. There's also quite a few. So there's several ones having to do with the Standing Judicial Commission. So let's say you have the session makes a decision that you really disagree with. Like, in fact, you say this violates our mission as the church. I object to this strenuously, and you bring it to the session. The session says, we hear your complaint. You say, I want to file a complaint about this, and we say, we hear your complaint, but we do stand behind our decision. Well, then at that point, you can appeal that complaint to the presbytery. And then the presbytery will have to hear your complaint. And the presbytery would take that, and they would say, okay, well, Bailey session, you either did not err in this decision, or you did err, and you need to correct it. And let's say they say, well, this Bailey session did not err. And you still feel like, well, I think that the presbytery got it wrong. You can then appeal it up higher, and the next highest level beyond the presbytery is the Standing Judicial Commission. It's like our Supreme Court when it comes to the church courts. And so, so there are several requests. We are still dealing with the fallout from the Revoice Conference of 2018, remember in the Human Sexuality Report, we talked about that side B sexuality, side B Christianity, where people were saying they were identifying as gay Christians, but they were still going to maintain the biblical sexual ethic and be celibate, but they would still identify their orientation as gay or homosexual. Remember, we were talking about that in Sunday school? Well, that's the side B type thing. Well, there's a teaching elder in St. Louis, in the Missouri Presbytery, who had organized this conference for Revoice, was at the center of all that, and so he was brought up on trial, and he was there's a whole mess. There's 100 pages of standing judicial opinion in the commissioner handbook. And by the way, this is a select printing. Okay, the actual commissioner's handbook is 800 pages. It's over 800 pages. It was 787 pages, and then they dropped a 150-page supplement this week, which was 75 pages of corrections and 50 pages of new material. So I selectively print things, and then basically they say bring an iPad. That's what you do, unless you want to lug that thing around in two binders. But so basically, what's happened, though, is that the Standing Judicial Commission basically has said the Missouri Presbytery did not convict Teaching Elder Johnson of the specific charges that he was charged with. The Standing Judicial Commission agreed, after it was complained and appealed, agreed that the Presbytery did not err in their particular fine points of the case that was brought to them. However, they were not able to include any of the statements, interviews, or even the book this teaching elder published after the case had already been brought, because it was not within the purview of the case. And so now we have multiple requests from two presbyteries who are asking for the Standing Judicial Commission to essentially to try teaching Elder Johnson as the court, to take over and be the responsible court to try him, especially based upon the interview he just did with NPR recently, which was atrocious, and the book that he just published, in which he identified himself as a gay Christian, as a, you know, as he uses the terms of homosexual Christian, and uses these terms that we have explicitly said you cannot use. And so there are two requests for the SJC to basically prosecute him and bring that case. There's also a couple other ones that have to do with kind of how that process works. I won't get into all that. Let's see here. Oh, we do have a petition for the U.S. government regarding abortion. About ending it. We are in a historic moment with the Supreme Court seemingly poised to overturn Roe v. Wade, and so it seems to be fitting time to appeal to the U.S. government, simply as the church, to say we want the end of abortion to be brought. Now, and some may say, well, why don't we do this every year? Why don't we make statements all the time about lots of different political subjects? Because actually in our Book of Church Order, we believe that the church and government operate on separate orbits. Now those orbits do cross every once in a while, but we do not take it upon ourselves to make statements into politics very often. And as evidence of that, our last humble petition to the government on the issue of abortion was in 1986. Okay? And it doesn't mean we've abdicated our responsibility. It just means that we are very careful about our timing. And we don't do petitions because we would endlessly be petitioning the government for everything. So this petition is being brought. I think it is timely. I think it is good to pass through and to express our humble petition to the government that we desire to see abortion brought to an end. So there's a related statement on political violence. I don't know how that one's going to go. I've seen an amended version of this go through, but we have seen a severe uptick on political violence. Now, last year there was a overture that was asking the PCA to condemn violence against Asian Americans because you had that spa shooting in Georgia and you had a bunch of instances of that. And rather than making a petition to the government or an official declarative statement, we took that moment to at the assembly to simply express our condemnation of violence towards Asian Americans and to pray for, particularly for, you may not know this, but at least 15% of the PCA is Korean. It's made of Korean churches and Korean speaking churches. So we took that time to pray for our Asian brothers and sisters in our denomination and in the country who had been undergoing a lot of attacks. And so I wouldn't be surprised if this one goes a similar way. Because like I just said, I mean, we the last time we made a statement on abortion was in 86. So, like, and especially in recent years, we've kind of grown, the assembly's grown a bit weary with a lot of these kind of, well, let's say this now. It's just, because it just feels like you're just flapping in the wind, of everything that's blowing this way or that way. And it's kind of like, look, we're trying to keep our eyes on the prize here, the gospel. And so, but there are times when things need to be said. So, I don't know. I'm kind of two minds about that statement. So there's a section in there that someone has asked to be taken out. Maybe it's a little more amenable. But I don't know. We'll see. But finally, this brings us back to the revoice and the issue. So, last year, the assembly overwhelmingly passed amendments to our Book of Church Order to modify the Book of Church Order concerning the qualifications to be a minister and the qualifications of candidates and interns. There's two separate sections in our Book of Church Order. And they were going to include some explicit language about, essentially, character qualifications. And one of the things that was a part of that was that you cannot identify, you cannot make your core identity associated with sin. Hence, like a gay Christian. You cannot do that. You can't be a lustful Christian. You can't be, you know, we can't do that. So that you cannot be a minister and do that as well. Well, those amendments, even though they were passed overwhelmingly at General Assembly, they narrowly failed to be confirmed to the presbyteries. Because amendments have to be passed at General Assembly, then they have to be approved by two-thirds of the presbyteries, and then they have to be confirmed back at the next assembly. And so those amendments did fail barely, by razor-thin margins. And there's a variety of reasons. It's not just that there's a third of the PCA that is affirmative of side B Christianity. There's a lot of guys who are just kind of like, the BCO is good and we need to quit changing it. Like, quit changing it all. You know, it's just, you know, the OPC makes fun of us because our comes in a binder, theirs is bound in a book. Look, that's how often they change the Book of Church Order. It's literally bound in a book, where ours comes in a three-ring binder. You know, like, so there's those types of guys. There's other guys who just had an immediate kind of, they didn't like the language, too vague, it was a little too weird, they thought it could just, it was too technical, so there was a lot, and then there were some people that had issues with it because they had sympathies for the side B guys. So, but there was enough issues where it didn't pass in two-thirds of the presbyteries. Well, that meant that there were presbyteries that went back, they listened, and so they have now presented new, so we have five overtures 12, 15, 20, 23, and 29, that deal with modifying the qualifications for church office in the Book of Church Order, which is 16-4. And so, and I agree with others that 29 is probably the strongest and clearest. I hope that they'll pick that up in the overtures committee and make that the representative one. But it just makes it clear. They basically simplify the language. Clarified it, reduced it down to very simple, simple language, and so. And then I actually have that. See, even again, this is even stuff here. So, let's see here. I was going to just read to you. Let's see, 29. So, I even sent the Office Depot and got the same. Well, actually, I didn't tell them to find it. They just downed it for some reason. So, all right. So it says that they want to change this to officers in the Presbyterian Church in America must be above reproach in their walk and Christ-like in their character. Those who deny the sinfulness of fallen desires, or who deny reality and hope of progressive sanctification, or who fail to pursue spirit and power of victory over their sinful temptations, inclinations, and actions, are not qualified for ordained office. So that's pretty good language. It's pretty clear and pretty effective. So we have five of those, and then we have one overture 31, that wants to change the requirements for ordination to church office for ministers. Now, what's interesting is there's overtures 33 to 35 that basically say were submitted that say, hey, look, let's commend all the presbyteries to make use of the human sexuality report that we came out last year that we commended already. And basically the idea is that there are people who don't want to change the Book of Church Order. And so my thinking is that they have submitted these 33, 34, and 35 to hopefully as kind of a halfway in between, so that way we wouldn't have to modify the Book of Church Order. But I would actually vote no against these, because it's basically saying, like, look, we got pious advice in our report last year. Somebody else wrote this, and I agree with them. They said basically it's pious advice about pious advice. They're saying, let's agree with it again. It's like, well, we've already commended it to the presbyteries. We did that last year. But if we need to change the Book of Church Order, then we need to change the Book of Church Order. So that's the question. So I'll probably vote negative on those and vote yes for the BCO amendments. And then the last thing I just want to mention, because we need to end here, but is that our denomination also put out, this is the last study committee that we're going to have for a while. It's actually, the study committee was appointed in 2019. on domestic abuse and sexual assault. So this is basically kind of a pastor manual. And so it's really, really, I'm working through it. It's very good. It's very helpful. And basically, it gives a theology of abuse, kind of understanding how that, and it's very pastoral, especially it's a good resource for pastors to go through, and they have a lot of cases. One of the people on the committee that was an advisor to the committee was Rachel Den Hollander, I think. She was an Olympic athlete who was abused by Larry Nassar, who had grossly abused a lot of female Olympic athletes. She was one of those who's become a public advocate. I believe she's a Reformed Baptist, but she was also an advisor on the committee as well, that helped advise the committee. And so it's a very good report. I'm hearing great things about it. I've been working through it. It's really good. So it's hard reading, but it's very good stuff and very helpful, because unfortunately we do live in a world of sin, and so we do come across this. So that is a preview. I will give you all a report when I get back to General Assembly on how the overtures go. Sorry we didn't really have time to do question and answer, but if you have any questions or concerns as I prepare to go to General Assembly, please talk to me and let me know, and we'll talk. So thank y'all.